Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer in Tel Aviv. Since October 7th, Israel has been so caught up in the dramatic events playing out close to home, they've had little bandwidth for what's happening in the rest of the world. But even in the midst of war and conflict, Israelis sat up and took notice by a dramatic headline on the cover of the magazine Atlantic. It declared that the golden age of American Jews is ending. Anti-Semitism on the right and the left threatens to bring to a close an unprecedented period of safety and prosperity for Jewish Americans and demolish the liberal order they helped establish. Here to discuss that disturbing declaration and what brought him to that conclusion is the article's author, Franklin Foer. Frank is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He was previously the editor of The New Republic and a staff writer at Slate and New York Magazine. He is the author of two books, The Last Politician, Inside Joe Biden's White House and the Struggle for America's Future, and World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Frank, welcome and thank you so much for agreeing to come on the Haaretz podcast.
So good to be here.
There has been so much reporting every day on what's happening to Jews in America right now since October 7th and over the course of the war for 5 months. We cover it all at Haaretz. But your article seems to me to go beyond journalism, although it's full of amazing reporting. It reads like a history book. You trace the march of progress Jews have made in America across the generations following the large immigration at the beginning of the 20th century. The reasons for that progress and the reasons for its demise and why you are so pessimistic about its future. I'll just quote you to yourself. You write, quote, "The forces arrayed against Jews on the right and the left are far more powerful than they were 50 years ago. The surge of anti-Semitism is a symbol of the decay of democratic habits, a leading indicator of rising authoritarianism. When anti-Semitism takes hold, conspiracy theories harden into conventional wisdom, embedding violence in thought and then in deadly action." So my first question is, what is it about what is happening and what has happened over the past 5 months that leads you to this assertion? Passover is coming up, so I'll put it in Seder language. Why is this crisis different from all of the other crises that have come before it?
Right. I guess the other, I could answer you in Haggadah, which is, you know, in every generation, a pharaoh arises. So after October 7th, I think a lot of American Jews had an intuition that something was changing. And I think it was something that a lot of American Jews feared was coming down the pike, but we didn't know when it would arise, and we didn't know if this was just a matter of filtering our present-day experience through all of our historical memories, through all of our rituals, through this giant cycle of Jewish history that we're all so intimately familiar with, when golden ages of diasporas arise and everything seems like it's going so swimmingly. Everybody feels like they've arrived at the safest place they've ever been in Jewish history. And then all of a sudden, everything comes crashing down. And for American Jews, I think that sensation began really not on October 7th, but it began for many of us. This is not universal. I don't want to lump every American Jew into one bucket because we're hardly a monolithic crowd. But after the election of Donald Trump, you started to hear from especially American Jews who were in the center or left of center that they had this intuition that something had changed with his election because there were so many things that it had stirred up, and he seemed to be winking at all of these anti-Semitic white supremacists. And then you have Charlottesville, and then you have the Tree of Life Synagogue. And then after October 7th, you know, in that window when, you know, after the horrific attacks of that day and before the Israeli war truly began, you had all of these people who had no sympathy for what had happened to Jews, and immediately started blaming Israel for what had happened. And it's in that window, I think there was this just sense of abandonment and disappointment that felt like a harbinger of something much worse that was to come. And lo and behold, in the months that have followed, you just have this upspring, especially on the left in progressive communities, of sympathy for the Palestinians, which on one level would be totally understandable. But on another level, the way that they talked about Zionism, the way that the fervor ends up expressing itself in their protest is not that they're decrying Netanyahu, not that they're decrying a certain war strategy, but it seemed like they just didn't believe Israel had a right to exist. There was something fundamentally illegitimate about Israel. And the way that they talked about Zionism seemed like it was a synonym for Jew. And that seemed to translate into a wide array of targeting of Jewish stores and a wellspring of bullying against Jewish kids and vandalism of synagogues, and then all sorts of just random incidents that felt like you couldn't wish them away. My neighbor, who's a rabbi, was walking home from shul, and somebody rolled down the window and started shouting about how, you know, calling her a kike and screaming about the Jews. Or I have a friend whose 12-year-old daughter was standing in the Upper West Side of Manhattan just holding a phone, and somebody comes up to her and starts accosting her and asking her what her position on the Gaza war is. And those random little incidents just felt like omens that everybody was experiencing. And what I tried to do with my article was to try to provide a framework for trying to understand and you know, how do we intellectually make sense of these intuitions that we've all had in the past months?
So you see the end of the golden age of American Jews as linked to the end of liberalism as a driving force in American society. Jews have embraced and pretty much embodied liberalism. I mean, obviously because they believed in it, but also because they benefited it, you know, fighting for equal rights, minority rights, freedom of religion, freedom from religion. And it allowed for this American Jewish identity that was on one hand tribal and on the other hand proudly American, especially after 1967, where Jews felt like they could be full-fledged loyal Americans and still be proud Jews, not only religiously, but, you know, in Zionism, tied to the state of Israel, sending their kids to these Jewish Zionist summer camps. And this was what you wrote, you know, a challenge and something different than all of these years and centuries in Europe, where there was so much more pressure to give up identity in exchange for citizenship. And American Jews who supported Israel being called disloyal or fifth columnist was viewed as this fringe far-right phenomenon until, as you say, what began on September 11th and then intensified in the Trump era. But we considered it, or I would say, you know, speaking for liberal American Jews and liberal Israelis too, that it was a threat that largely emanated from the right. So did we have a blind spot to what was happening and developing on the left that led to the level of surprise we're experiencing now? I had last month Rabbi Sharon Brous on the podcast, and we were talking about the Women's March incident, and she kind of admitted as such. She said there were red flags that she tried hard as she could to pretend they weren't there because she didn't want them to be there. And you also, I think, you know, talk about in your article that you failed to appreciate the extent of anti-Semitism on the left because you kind of identified with its criticisms of the Israeli government. Can you talk about that, reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I mean, I admit to having the same sort of blind spot. And it's not without reason. I mean, I think if you go back and you look at the long span of American political history, in the global left, sure, there was like lots of anti-Semitism on the global left, and there were flashpoints of anti-Semitism on the American left. But if you go back and you just trace it through and you look at the foundation of the Ku Klux Klan and you look at a lot of the people who ended up founding the American conservative movement, you had a lot of anti-Semites there. And a lot of this was mixed in with the whole isolationist trend within American conservatism. American conservatism was born in a way out of the isolationism of Charles Lindbergh and of people who opposed World War II. Largely, you know, there was a lot of sympathy towards the Nazis that existed within that group. And then kind of moving forward through the John Birch Society and all the way through the present, there was this clear as day strain of right-wing anti-Semitism. But on the left, or at least, you know, among liberal Jews, there was a sense that we could make common cause with the civil rights movement and with the Democratic Party, and that all of this was a means of self-protection for the reasons that you described in your question, which was that, you know, the protection of minority rights for all would end up protecting American Jews. The protection of civil liberties would protect American Jews. And a certain idea of multiculturalism, which Jews actually helped to invent, meant that within America, it was possible to maintain your Jewishness. You didn't have to be erased as a Jewish individual in order to become a full citizen like you did in Europe. And, you know, but I think in our polarized times, there is this strong desire to see the other side as the primary threat. And there becomes this almost self-protective mechanism that you have. You don't want to see the flaws in your friends. And this is true not just for Jews. It's true for all partisans in our era. And that affected me as well. I mean, I saw Donald Trump. I saw the way in which his final campaign ad flashed images of George Soros and Lloyd Blankfein and Janet Yellen and described them as globalists who were preying on the people. And I thought, oh my, that is clear as day as a threat. And so that was the thing that I was most worried about. And then I saw the way in which conspiracies about George Soros ended up percolating into the Tree of Life massacre. But there were those red flags. There was the Women's March and the way that Jews were excluded from the list of concerns and the ways in which Jewish leaders were alienated and forced to apologize. There was the way in which in a lot of the LGBTQ movements, you know, gay, lesbian Jews who wanted to express their identity were told that they couldn't do that because to do that would make them members of the left in bad standing. And then on college campuses, there were all these things that were happening over the years, many of them targeting Hillel and shutting Hillel out of broader left-wing political alliances. All of these red flags, all of these things that I admit that I ended up downplaying in my own head because I was so focused on the other threat.
And when congresswomen like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar would tweet things and the right would point fingers and call anti-Semitism, we would view it as just basically, you know, partisan fire with no basis in truth.
I mean, I'd like to think that I saw the clear anti-Semitism there, but it felt like those were outliers. They weren't emblematic figures, whereas Donald Trump was the leader of his party.
As we record, we have a story on our homepage about Jewish students and faculty holding this mass demonstration at Berkeley, protesting the inadequate response of the administration to anti-Semitic violence, no free speech for Jewish students. Berkeley seems to be ground zero of what's going on now. And you did reporting there, correct? Not just about what's happening in universities, but in the high schools and down to elementary schools. Can you talk about what you found there?
Yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, it was one thing you talk about blind spots and things that you didn't expect. I didn't expect that the Bay Area would become a proving ground for anti-Semitism. And so first I saw the viral videos that were coming out of these city council meetings in the Bay where people were just were accusing Israel of fabricating evidence of the massacres of October 7th. Just really deranged stuff was emanating from these meetings. And then around the time of Hanukkah, I saw pictures on social media of a menorah that was sitting in Oakland, downtown Oakland, on the shores of Lake Merritt. And the menorah had been desecrated, thrown into the water, replaced by graffiti, making ominous threats towards Jewish people. And so I started making calls to various community leaders. And the thing that they told me that was so surprising was that this was manifesting itself in schools, that they were getting all sorts of reports of bullying being directed at Jewish students, that teachers in these schools were just consumed by issues of the war, and they couldn't help but turning their classrooms into pulpits, and they started sermonizing about what was happening in the war. And of course, kids, if they're given a simplistic interpretation of the conflict, they're then going to turn around and act on that in their own environment. So if they're told that the Jews were bad people who came in and stole land, then they're going to just start to blame that on the Jews they see closest at hand, which is their classmates. And so I saw this epidemic of bullying, and it ended up, especially if you had a yarmulke, if you had a kippah, you were a target. But I saw stories, heard stories about how this had transmitted itself all the way down into elementary schools, where 6 and 7 year old kids were asking their teachers, you know, can we divide the class into Palestinian and Israeli teams? Palestinians and Israelis can't be friends. And that to me is horrifying, not just about the moment, but about where this all might lead, that kind of simplistic moralism, the dividing of the world into good and evil, where Jews are placed on the side of evil, that to me is just about the scariest thing that I've seen.
Yeah, here in Israel, American immigrants and European immigrants often compare notes, and American, North American Jews who moved to Israel are horrified at the stories of not being able to walk on the streets of Paris or London wearing a kippah, being visibly Jewish. It was just something we could not conceive of as American Jews, and now it seems to be day-to-day life in many communities.
I still don't think it's quite day-to-day life in American communities. I think that it's still not Paris here. I think things have taken a turn, and things are not, you know, relative to the paradise that we existed in before, it's not great. But it's you know, I would say as a Jew walking down the streets of Washington, D.C., I see a lot of, I see more graffiti that makes me anxious, you know, at the foot of my street. I live in Cleveland Park in Washington, D.C. At the foot of my street, somebody spray painted on a box, MPD, Metropolitan Police DeForce, KKK, Ku Klux Klan, IDF. And that to me was like, that was eye-opening because it was so close to my house. And I told you the story about my neighbor, but I've never experienced anything where I felt like, oh, I'm in an ominous interaction. Oh, somebody is targeting me. Oh, I feel unsafe riding the subway. But then again, I don't wear a kippah. And I know if you do wear a kippah, if you do have that Jewish marker on you, you do become much more of a target. But even still, I think we're not there.
I think one of your most important points in your article is this, I'll quote you again, that Nazi Germany excluded Jews from the category we now call whiteness. Today, Jews are treated in sectors of the left as the epitome of whiteness, but any analysis that focuses so relentlessly on the role of privilege, as the left does, will be dangerously blind to anti-Semitism because anti-Semitism itself entails an accusation of privilege. So the old view of a united left, you know, minorities and liberal activists, Jews in the forefront, locking arms against oppression and racism and discrimination. Has that old picture broken down completely? To paraphrase from David Baddiel, do Jews not count as minorities anymore?
Sadly, in many quarters, no. I mean, I don't want to paint with quite too broad a brush because there's still, to use a piece of jargon, there's still plenty of allies out there within progressive circles. But I think that the problem is that the whole gestalt, like the whole way that the left views the world, this view of intersectionality, the way in which the world gets drawn into oppressors and oppressed, really just doesn't have a place for making sense of anti-Semitism for the reason that you just described, because it's not about oppression. It's about, you know, a conspiracy theory that puts Jews in danger. And, you know, this is just emblematic of the way in which Jews have always broken the world's brain, that when it comes to the categories that the world has for separating out and organizing people, Jews are an outlier. We're not a race. We're not an ethnicity. We're not just a religion. We're a people. And the world struggles to understand that. And then when the world breaks down into these simplistic analyses about oppressors and oppressed, then there's really just, Jews don't count because there is no place for us in that simplistic organization of the world.
So does the fact that events in Israel has triggered all this, in a foreign country is affecting American life and American Jewish life so strongly. Is that because Israel somehow magnifies what the left sees as excessive power and privilege and oppression? And do you think that maybe even President Biden's support for Israel at the beginning of the war magnified that?
I do. I do. I mean, I think that even before this war on the left, you had ways in which there had been various, especially in the pro-Palestinian movement, there have been some very shrewd moves that they have made in order to cultivate the left, whether it is depicting the Palestinians as an indigenous people and then making kind of common cause with all of the other indigenous rights movements in America, which means that when you teach in California schools, there's something called ethnic studies. It's a required class in ninth grade. And one of the subjects that they study are Native Americans. A lot of those teachers are instantly, even before October 7th, making this connection between the Palestinians and the Native Americans. So yes, I think that Israel, Biden's support, all these things exacerbate things that existed beforehand. I think that the BDS movement was very successful in replicating a lot of the moral inclinations of the rising progressive left in the way in which it created an architecture of good guys and bad guys and a strong desire to ostracize the bad guys, and also the sense that there was this party line ticket that you needed to vote about all the causes that you supported. And if you didn't support all the righteous causes, then you were no longer admitted into the category, you know, into the category of the angels. You became an ally of the devils. And BDS had installed itself within the pantheon of the angels. And so to be pro-Israel, even critical of the occupation, even critical of the prevailing government, you got cast on the side of the devils. And that was true before October 7th, but there's no doubt that everything after October 7th has just exacerbated everything that was out there before.
Do you feel American Jews who are on liberal and on the left are angry at Israel for, quote unquote, doing this to them?
I think that there's a lot of complicated feelings. And I do hear that. I definitely hear that. And I was just thinking as I was describing that, the ways in which the pro-Palestinian groups in America have been so attuned to changes in American culture and on the American left. And I think Israel has largely, you know, as always, kind of for various reasons, had this complicated relationship with the diaspora and hasn't really been attuned to the changes within American politics or within American culture. And so ended up missing all of these big currents and never had a strategy for how it could contend with them. And I think that's true of American Jews to some extent because of the willful blindness that we described before. But I hear this. I mean, somebody sent me a note last week saying that they had two reactions to my piece. One was that they were angry at Israel, specifically Netanyahu, for making things so much worse here in America. And then their second reaction is, well, maybe I should make Aliyah to Israel. And so those two thoughts can exist within people's minds at the same time. And I see that there is, you know, that there is so much anger and frustration directed towards Netanyahu, and then so much anger and frustration directed at the American left, and love of Israel and anger at Israel. They all exist in this complicated swirl inside people's heads.
You've been writing stories before this big story about the war and what's going on in Israel. You interviewed a family of a hostage. You wrote about the Biden's endgame, Israel's endgame in Gaza. And hearkening back to a story you wrote in October 10th, you wrote, "Biden will be guided by his Zionism." And in that piece, you talked about Biden's unconditional support for Israel at the time. You wrote that any president would express robust support for Israel in the aftermath of the Hamas attack. But the question is how those feelings of solidarity will survive during the slog of war. So that was written on October 10th. How have they survived? And how do you see Biden handling the pushback against his support for Israel, his basically unconditional support for Israel?
I mean, it's I think it is testimony to the fact that he really does love Israel, that he's not pivoted, he's not wavered really until this late moment. And I think that his frustrations, some of them are born of politics, clearly, but I think a lot of them are just born of the fact that he's had the style of dealing with Netanyahu over the long run, which involves almost a Socratic relationship with Netanyahu, that he's resisted, I think, in private, dictating to Netanyahu, but he's tried to ask him questions that will highlight the stakes of various issues or try to sharpen his thinking when his thinking is muddy. And Biden has spent all this time on regional diplomacy, which has had the effect of, I think, diffusing a wider war, but also left Israel in this position where, on October 10th, when I wrote that article, I was hearing from people within the Biden administration, we don't think Saudi normalization is done. We think that there's still a chance of getting a Saudi normalization deal. And I laughed at them. And then lo and behold, we're here in March, however many months later, and there is this possibility of getting this deal with normalization, not just with the Saudis. I think that there's some hope that they can get it with the Qataris as well, which seems kind of amazing to me. But that, largely focused on Saudi Arabia, and that then you'd have this other plan that would refinance the reconstruction of Gaza and have a long-term vision for the reconstruction of Gaza. I kind of find this all incredible that this is even a possibility, given all the way in which the disturbing, you know, images that Arabs understandably find disturbing have flooded social media. And so, Biden feels like, I've done this heroically diplomatic thing on behalf of Israel that's in the best interest of Israel. And, Bibi won't even consider it because of his political considerations. He's not, I think that's the point at which Biden started to break. It's not so much the politics of it all, though that's clearly there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for Bibi is prioritizing his own political survival over it. All of this great vision that we have that involves Qatar and Saudi and reconstruction relies on Netanyahu taking positions that would basically make his government self-destruct. So in Israel, this great vision that Biden has is viewed as an unrealistic pipe dream.
Understandably so. I mean, I think that to survive the trauma of October 7th and then to experience the trauma of wars and to leave a war, the prospect of leaving a war unfinished, given everything, is a high price to ask, not just Netanyahu, but any Israeli politician to pay. But I think that we're in a moment that demands creativity and imagination, and Israel can't just think about tomorrow. It needs to have some sort of vision for how it can contend with this over the long run, knowing that occupation is not really an adequate solution to the problem because of all the costs that's just going to exact for Israel, not just diplomatically and in the global order, but I think it's a horrible price for Israel to have to pay for itself, given all of the resources, given all of the risk that entails. And so, what Israel needs, and I think has in various sectors, but not just in the office of the prime ministership, is just some political imagination and some political courage and some political creativity to be able to accomplish short-term strategic goals while having some sense of how in the next decade this is going to work out.
I want to close out with asking you on a more personal note. You write about so many aspects of American politics and society. The last time you did a deep dive into Jewish identity was when you looked at events in the Holocaust with your mother's book around the time of the Ukraine war. Jewish introspective is kind of your family business, right? Your mother writes about it. Your brother writes about it. You write about a much wider range of topics and issues. Was writing this story different for you because it was so personal?
Absolutely. I mean, it was, I felt genuine anxiety and tension just having to confront the fact that American society had become less hospitable to Jews than I had wanted to believe. The headline of my story is very pessimistic, and a lot of my story is very pessimistic. But I think that there is a condition in between the Shoah and the paradise that we used to live in the United States. And that is a return to a more normal form of Jewish history where it's possible to live everyday Jewish life, but it's just punctuated by episodes of anti-Semitism that cause a sense of insecurity and fear. And I think that could be something closer to the new status quo here. Maybe not even as bad as it is in Paris, but far, far less safe than it was before.
Wow, it feels really rude to end a podcast by telling you that I really hope you're wrong.
Yeah, me too.
But I kind of do hope you are. Franklin Foer, I'm so grateful to you for coming on the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks to my guest, Franklin Foer, and to my producer and editor, Nara Malkin. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, shalom from Tel Aviv.